Today we're going to talk about the weeping angels of site reliability. If you don't watch them carefully, they will sneak up and get you. So I'll have everybody on the panel here introduce themselves briefly, and then we'll jump right into it, starting from the end here.
Sure. Hi, my name is Jamie Tomasello. I am the Technology Director for Access. Access is an international nonprofit that defends and extends the digital rights of users that are at risk around the world. From a technology perspective, we have a digital security helpline that runs 24/7 to help journalists, bloggers, NGOs, civil society organizations with any digital security issues they may have, anything from setting up PGP to help my site is under DDoS to help me set up a VPN because I'm traveling to China.
My name is Pete Cheslock. I run operations and support for a company called ThreatStack. We do continuous security monitoring, capturing all of the Linux syscall events and analyzing them and looking for anomalies in system events.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the LinkedIn SRE team. I primarily support our common growth groups, but security is something that is very important to me.
Hi, I'm Corey Scott, Director of House Security at LinkedIn. I'd like to say I've made my return to a Usenix event after 13 years. I presented on IDS at LISA in 2002, so I'm glad to be back. My team is responsible for everything from penetration testing to security monitoring and incident response at LinkedIn.
Hi, I'm Ryan Boyd with Groupon. My team runs global email ops related to deliverability, email security, and adminning MTAs.
And I'm Mark Risher. I head up spam and abuse at Google, which covers a wide gamut from accounts to apps to Gmail to cloud platform, Play, social, a wide variety of attacks across Google. And I'm glad to be here at Usenix. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
So we have structured this to cover some of the common vectors of abuse and attack that you should be aware of when you're thinking of reliability as something beyond just site up. And our video reference is to the weeping angels, which are creatures that only move when you're not looking at them and will do nasty things to you if they manage to catch you. So moving on, the abuse vectors that I've put into six different categories here. The first one are people who will ride on your reputation. So you've got a good name as Google or as Twitter or as LinkedIn or OpenDNS, and somehow somebody wants to take advantage of that. Ryan, you want to talk about what happened with Groupon?
Sure. Yep. So at Groupon, we're in 47 countries with over 260 million subscribers at this point. So we have a large brand around email. And what we found going way back, I believe this specific example that we have up here was the fall of 2012, that there were bad actors, malicious users that were using our brand to deliver malware, which raised obvious issues. Actually, if you could flip back, one on that.
Okay.
One. Mm-hmm. So as it relates to email, we had implemented SPF and DKIM on the authentication side, which put us in a good place, but we hadn't looked at DMARC yet, which builds on top of SPF and DKIM and allows for reporting and proactive blocking and mitigation around these types of issues. So this example that we have up here, the email on the left is the one that actually references the malware via the executable attachment, and the one on the right is the actual legit email that we send. So to an average user, you know, given 2 or 3 seconds looking at an email, that isn't inherently discernible. So that's why DMARC moved rapidly up our roadmap, so our end users and end users of email didn't really have to make that decision anymore. And then the unfortunate byproduct outside of distributing malware and all of the nasty stuff that came with that were fun headlines like this, which no one wants to deal with as it relates to uptime or anything along those lines. So part of our process as it relates to DMARC was taking all of our domains, stack ranking them, and looking at our authentication results, which gives us a good idea of who's passing, who's failing, and where we need to go to fix those problems. So the slide that we have here shows our SPF and DKIM passes, failures, and then the overall trend. And we executed against that over several quarters across, like I said earlier, about 47 different countries to make sure everyone, as it relates to our main commercial mailing domains, our publishing and reject record, which we've seen has dramatically decreased the amount of phishing and malicious attacks on our brand overall. The benefit of this, of DMARC at large, is that we're now able to block those specific issues. So this one that we have here, believe this was in Brazil probably 3 or 4 months ago. The example on the left is the email that they lifted from our daily commercial mail, adjusted the top deal to reference an iPhone offer that was not legit, obviously. They were looking to steal credit card information. But the silver lining here is the graph on the right. So those three spikes are essentially Gmail, Hotmail, and Yahoo, and the amount of messages that we were able to proactively block just by having DMARC implemented. So it was a fairly large win for us, and these days having DMARC rolled out globally, these are few and far between. We've made it such that it isn't inherently profitable anymore to leverage our brand, and have driven them elsewhere.
Any comments from anyone else on the panel about similar issues you've dealt with your brands? Or?
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons that we're at SREcon is talking about these unintended consequences that might affect site reliability, that might affect the site. And one of those issues that comes into place here is when the bad guys are essentially using your infrastructure as an indirect part of their campaign. So Kurt mentioned if you have a redirect function or if you have a content hosting function, then there might be something that's totally off your network, like an email campaign between Hotmail and Comcast, but the URL in it or the image that's appearing in it or the link to a page that has an iframe is served from your side. And so one of the challenges in the site reliability aspects is that this reputation might be happening in ways that you have no direct way to monitor or observe. And that's why we're trying to, as we work through this presentation, give you ideas about how to preemptively block that and ensure you don't become or don't get swept up in that sort of campaign.
Corey, you want to talk about your favorite topic of Belgicom?
Sure. So last year, it was disclosed through Der Spiegel, through some of the things that were happening with GCHQ, where there was an attack against Belgian Telecom, and they have a particular relay point where they could inject man-in-the-middle attacks, including delivering targeted malware for tailored access operations against against employees in Belgian Telecom. But they didn't want to target all Belgian Telecom employees because it's too noisy of an attack. So you just don't want to take everything that's behind that one netted IP and just start injecting malware all over the place. But so what they did was they targeted both Slashdot and LinkedIn members because at the time we were not using HTTPS by default. And so you could uniquely identify the particular member that was making a connection to LinkedIn or to Slashdot, and then it provide a malicious JavaScript that would redirect the user to a malware and a drive-by download. So that they could get the malware to the people that they were targeting, and which in this case were IT technicians, people who work in operations.
And this worked because the URL would distinctly identify who the user was?
Yes, in this case, a cookie. Yes.
Right. Okay.
And also because it was not HTTPS by default, which I think is the takeaway lesson here, is that your site should always be using HTTPS with forward secrecy.
The nice thing is SSL Labs has their scanner, so there's really no reason anymore not to have your site be, an A+ and have perfect forward secrecy. There's a lot of easy tools out there that should be simple to set up.
Yeah, and for those of you who are not familiar with the term GCHQ, that's the British intelligence agency. So this isn't something that is just, it's some foreign actor or state-sponsored attack out of China or something else. This actually also happens with first-world country governments, the Five Eyes. Yeah, it happens to us. It could be anyone. So it is something to consider when protecting your users.
So moving on to the second sort of category are reflection attacks. And many people know about the old open SMTP relays. And since that time, it's been discovered that many other internet protocols are subject to the same sorts of problems. We've got open DNS resolvers. We've got open NTP resolvers. In general, the Open Resolver Project and its cousins have been working to try to close this down. But when you stand something up in your environment, in your infrastructure, whether that's in the cloud or whether it's on-prem, you need to be aware that these things can be exploited for amplification effects. Mm-hmm. Any comments from the panel on that?
Yeah, here again, amplification is one of those SRE-type topics where the bad guy is taking a small action but creating a disproportionate load. And so thinking about things that we've seen many times when we include, when you know, a product will include a sharing or a virality feature in the front end, that this gets attacked by the bad guys. So anything that says, you know, share this event or share this post or share this photo or share this URL or, you know, subscribe people to FeedBurner updates of this blog, all of those are forms of amplification whereby the bad guy can, you know, upload a fraudulent address book and then blast out to all of them an alert where the alert is actually the malicious payload here.
The other thing to consider during these types of events where it's an amplification attack or your site is under a DDoS or it's just a high traffic because there's there's an event going on, a thing to consider also is that it's not just your standard American user who may be using your platform and just, oh, well, you know, they just can't get to Twitter today. If you have to think about what global events are going on during Arab Spring, that Twitter as a platform was being used by civil society actors to communicate to the outside world what was going on, and it raises the severity of the outage. So sometimes it's important to take a step back and go, okay, I know that my platform is used for job seekers, or I know that my platform is used for these things, but for other people internationally, they use your platforms differently, and it can be used to communicate, to organize events, a matter of life and death, and it does raise the priority of your outage when that's their main form of communication with the outside world.
Yep. One other variant on that, potentially less severe but still crippling to a service, is the concept of celebrities. So as we and others have explored more and more social features, you find that sometimes there's a small population of users that is very, very appealing and that has a way disproportionate number of followers. So the CEO of your company, various Hollywood celebrities that may have accounts in your company, heads of state, these sorts of figures, though they're really a small portion, we've had, you know, there were stories I can think of where we've promoted, you know, oh, people like you also follow Lady Gaga, and suddenly Lady Gaga is getting 10,000, you know, friend requests a hour. And so these sorts of volume things are another type of amplification, which is sort of an unexpected consequence of treating celebrities just like the rest of us, which they're not.
The other thing you need to be aware of is making sure that your service can't be used as an oracle. So bad actors will try to find out what the source of truth is. They'll try to figure out, is this email address legitimate, by bouncing against servers. This is how takeovers such as Sarah Palin's email account was taken over, by figuring out what it was at Yahoo and then hacking it through some fairly simple social engineering and password guessing. But nonetheless, it was first determined to be valid by checking whether or not email could be sent there and not bounce. So likewise on your services, if you're Dropbox, can somebody figure out somebody's account name because you return a distinctive error code?
Can I be a little controversial on that one? So I think that is true, and there's risk there, but there's also risk to legitimate users of being so cloak and dagger mysterious that no one knows what's going on. And what I found in my experience is that the bad guys, you know, they're sort of black box QA testing our systems continuously. So yes, they will find if there's a simple Boolean test that says, you know, yes, we think that's malware, no, it's not, and, you know, give them that signal. But at the same time, they know your thresholds and are sending N-1 all the time. And so it ends up that the only people you're catching with your quotas are legitimate users who are confused, people that have, you know, spikes in traffic because they just had a baby, so they wrote to their whole address book, or people that are you know, experiencing or trying some new feature and don't know how it works, and so they're sending a high volume. And so I think if you're too cryptic, if you're too terse in your error codes, you end up really just dragging down legitimate users. And cases like the, you know, that username is not found versus if we find the username, we'll send a reset link, but we won't tell you if we did it or not, like, does sometimes have this user experience load that shifts the problem onto your customer support team.
And Jamie, did you want to comment about the idea of fraudulent lockouts?
Sure. So one of the problems that we receive all the time at the Digital Security Helpline is two different classes. So one would be an account recovery. An activist or a journalist says, I can't get into my account. And usually it's, oh, the account was compromised. But the other thing that we're seeing isn't just, oh, they lost their credentials or they were hacked into, but that the password reset functionality or the account lockout functionality is being abused. So what their assailants or their adversaries are doing is disabling their ability to communicate on email and other social platforms by locking their account. So they're sending too many false requests or too many false passwords because they know that's how they can silence this activist. And it's very difficult to go back and try to recover the account because many activists don't actually use Real ID for very good reasons. And one of the things that we have to do is work with the platform and say, this is actually a legitimate person. We have the account owner, and work with platforms to actually look at information other than, is this person who they claim to be, but does this person engage in the same behavior that they've done in the past? What can they look at that's more than just identity to prove that this is actually the owner of the account? That's one issue we have with lockouts. And the other problem that we have is when a journalist or an activist in the field is detained by law enforcement, and in certain countries they don't have the ability to contact Facebook and say, hey, can you shut off my account? They don't have the right to a first phone call most of the time. They can't get in touch with anyone. So we usually hear about it second or third hand, either from one of their legal representatives, like a lawyer, their family, or a civil society organization that they work with, saying this person's been detained. Can you please reach out to Facebook or Google or Hotmail or whoever, to Twitter, to have their account suspended? Now, you wouldn't think that they would want their account suspended, but the reason why is that they are commonly tortured for their credentials. And there are things in their email that will either cause them to go be jailed for longer or implicate other people. And so that request coming to us of, please get my account suspended, is an extremely important and a high priority item for us. And it was something that when I joined the organization, didn't expect to see that often and to really know what that use case is. But yeah, we're seeing abuse of account lockout, and we're seeing requests for suspensions a lot more than we'd ever expect to see.
So on to the next area. Mark alluded to this earlier of redirect links that might be an iframe that are pulling malware from your system in some fashion. This is hosted content. If the user can put anything on your system, don't trust it, effectively. So as there's obviously clearly bad content. There's malware, there's child pornography. There are ways to bounce through redirects. Link shorteners have this problem all the time, where they're being used to redirect to bad content. But let me ask you something that you might think initially is fairly innocuous. When is a name not a name? How many of you offer your users the opportunity to upload to set their name and put a profile picture? I see a few hands going up. Okay. What if that name was www.badware.com? What if that picture had steganographic commands for a botnet embedded in it? both of these have been seen and documented in the wild. That botnets are controlled by content that's buried in pictures, people's profile pictures, or names, which are not necessarily names. And you, we're all aware how much information you can get in 140 characters, thanks to Twitter. But the information density of different languages varies. 140 characters is reasonable for English, but in 40 characters, in Chinese, you can pack a whole lot more information in. And if your service is being used overseas in a multinational setting, you have to be aware of the information density that can be packed into what you consider a short string.
I think the key here, and one of the things that we're talking about, especially when it comes to international usage, is context is very, very important. Because it's not just, oh, my data shows me that in general it's 40 characters, or abuse happens to be this many logins. Sure, that's great if you're looking at a general American audience, but it may be different the way that your platform is used in Latin and South America and in China or in India. And the abuse and the statistics that you use, the metrics that you use to trigger rules and to trigger operational actions may be completely different from those regions. So you have to keep those things in mind.
Yeah, we see that on a rate limiting aspect many times, that different countries have different prevalence of NAT, different prevalence of unique IPs. And so quotas or rate limits that are attached to those sorts of resources may have wildly different response rates and effectiveness. Likewise, I got email from somebody in the Republic of Kiribati, which is a very small island that on Google Maps, it's really just blue. There's nothing there. But they're saying that they have very few landline phone numbers. And so when we ask them for a telephone verification, they're kind of maxed out because the whole island only has a few hundred numbers. So any of these scarce resources can vary dramatically from country to country.
And I know that there's a lot of people who use Tor exit nodes as an identifier of abuse, or to say, oh, we're not going to allow this traffic, or we're going to put up a capture or whatnot. But again, it depends on the usage of your platform. People have legitimate uses of Tor exit nodes, of the Tor network in general. And so you may be blocking people who should actually have access. And it's just knowing that context of how those things are used on your platform and not just blindly adding data or adding a tool that another platform may use but may not have the same platform usage that you all have.
So that's talking about some of the ways that your service can be abused, not just the content that you hosted. The link I put up there was for a hosting best practices document that was just published today by the MOG organization. And while you may not consider yourself a hosting organization or a cloud provider, like I say, if you allow your users to set their name, put in a profile picture, or provide any other content, you are, in some degree, hosting that content and making it available. So in terms of other ways that users can attack other users within your platform, Mark, you had some comments about unexpected changes in the in your service that might open up holes or cause response spikes. Did you want to say anything more in that?
Sure, if you like. So again, the common theme being how does abuse cause unexpected traffic, and how does that spill over into what we all in this room have to deal with? And the aspect here, I think, was around, I sort of alluded to earlier, around promotion features that might cause spikes in usage. And so this is intra-service in the sense that probably all of us are running services or products that are more and more interrelated, that have features to share outwards through different social media, features to consume things inwards, to import through APIs or to import through feeds. And these linkages then create, again, areas where something might come through. And the case in point I think that you're referring to was around some of the social features we launched on Hangouts, on our real-time communication, where we wanted to avoid the empty restaurant problem. So we said, let's suggest a few people that you might want to reach out to. And we got this by importing your address book. Well, the problem was that your contacts and address lists are not really distributed evenly and adiabatically. There are like, you know, huge spikes when everyone's following or everyone's tracking someone a particular interest. And so the load was then shifted disproportionately to that. And this then caused some outbound issues because we had notifications that went to other services that, you know, when you receive an invite, it's going to push it to your phone. So now the phone system is, the phone push notification system is getting overwhelmed. And so these sort of spillover things continue to grow and continue to snowball and can start with something relatively innocent like a, you know, well-intentioned product feature to promote a few people you might want to talk to.
Corey and Pete, you both had some thoughts around logging and authentication to help at least monitor this kind of intra-service activity.
Sure. So one of the things that I often see is one service that gets compromised in an environment then being used to compromise other services within that same ecosystem. There's some things that I've seen SREs and sysadmins do. I'm sure no one in this room has ever done these types of things, but I'll just kind of put them on the board just so that we're all aware of them, the fact that oftentimes credentials, particularly for certain key services, are stored in plain text in source code repositories or configuration files that allow for lateral movement within the environment. That's a pretty common unfortunate situation. Another is endpoint security. Again, how we talked about the quantum insert attack. You guys are one of the ones that are on the list to be targeted, and endpoint security is extremely important. And the tunnels that you create and you forward all around to bounce around your systems, I've seen cases where those are open instead of being bound to localhost, being bound to public IPs and allowing tunneling back into the environment. Also, we oftentimes will like to use services that have authentication as an option rather than as a mandatory feature. I'm thinking of caching systems in particular, that oftentimes hold sensitive data that you need to be aware of. And then finally, regarding logging, of course, as a security guy, as an incident responder, I love logs because they actually help me figure out what the hell happened. But the problem is that oftentimes logs can just tell us a little bit too much, like dumping user authentication cookies, not being respectful of user privacy settings, and creating a very interesting repository for attackers to actually figure out how to get additional access to member data in many cases. So I think this is just my ability to get on a soapbox here for a couple minutes and kind of just remind everyone about some of the things that we need to do to harden our infrastructures and provide defense in depth.
Yeah, I mean, something that we've seen with our customers, especially people who are high scale, high growth, and especially users of, you know, cloud services where, you know, infinite scale, is that more and more people have access to deploying those systems. And so if you're not kind of secure by default and instituting policies early on, trying to like bring them on after the fact is much, much harder. So the beautiful thing is Amazon gives you these tools, a lot of other cloud providers give you these tools, you know, VPC functionality, everything running through Bash and Host. We monitor our systems to make sure that the service is up and running, but how many people are monitoring for the behaviors of the actions on those systems? If someone logs into the VPN from an address that's never been logged in before, is that alerting someone? Is that waking up someone? It should be. If it's not, then you have something broken in your environment. There's a lot of tools out there that are easily accessible while painful to set up, like OSSEC or AuditD. They do exist, and you can get, you know, the kind of single source of truth from the audit subsystem if you're a Linux shop, everything that's happening on there. You know, the greatest joke about SE Linux is like the first rule of SE Linux is to turn it off, but please stop doing that. You know, it's there, it's good, it can protect you from mistakes. I think the biggest thing that we see as well is the same kind of junior sysadmin SRE who can kind of blow your budget away by spinning up too many systems might accidentally make some trivial change to a firewall or security group, and now it's, you know, trivial for an attacker to come in. Equally on the same side, using one-time passwords if at all possible Not storing secrets kind of in plain text is another big one, because I think what we see a lot of is not so much, and this is a lot with either like the bad actors or even, you know, the Five Eyes world, is they're not coming in the front door through the place where you've got all those protections. It's what they're doing is they want to get onto your laptop and onto your system, and that's where they start getting access to all your systems. So you kind of have to think about, like, what do you have access to? And if you can then monitor for those behaviors when they kind of fall outside of bounds, you know, that's when, you know, alertable conditions should happen.
The thing is, they're not going to barge through the front door. They're not, it's obviously, it's locked. I'm not going to do that. It's easier to circumvent your security. It's easier to circumvent any policies that you've got. So it's looking for the weakest link, whether it's a vendor, whether it is, you know, people usually think of the executive assistant as being a weak link, but they've been trained to be more mindful of this. And sometimes as engineers, we're like, no, we're secure, we're good. But we get lazy because we know too much sometimes for our own good. And we go, well, I can always do this, or I can always make this secure, but it's not necessarily a priority. I've seen situations where people have audit trails. They're like, yeah, great, we're auditing the actions of Root, but then we're not actually auditing anytime Root changes the logs, like actually edits or deletes logs. I'm like, well, that's kind of a bad thing if you've got all of a sudden Root access. And then obviously removing access. So as you've got somebody who grows in the organization, and they may have started with certain ops or DevOps access, and now that they're in management and they don't ever touch a machine, they actually don't need that access anymore. And it's politically difficult to get access turned off sometimes, but it's really important because they're the ones who are going to get hit.
I mean, it's the classic, you know, that poor CTO who wrote the initial version of the software. They probably shouldn't be still have Root access. They have to get their access removed. You know, they're spending their times in meetings, they're traveling wherever. I mean, I've worked in places where we would find out last minute when people were traveling to China, and, you know, we'd start asking questions like, well, you know, when are you going to China? Oh, next week. You know, you're bringing your laptop and your phone? Yeah, of course, why not? Like, no, you're not. Here's a Chromebook and a burner phone, you know. There's things that you don't think about, but, you know, that's where, it's like when you stop thinking, is that's where they're going to get you. It's like back to the weeping angels.
Right, exactly, if you're not keeping an eye on it. And even if your CTO doesn't have access, you have to be aware of people who redirect through your CTO or CEO. We had a situation where a phishing email was sent to our CEO. He forwarded it to the head of sales for Europe because it was dealing with something in Europe. And that person looked at it, saw it was forwarded from the CEO, and figured, okay, I better follow up on this. Proceeded to put in his credentials, and within the next day, we had to invalidate everybody's credentials because it had spread too widely and basically mailed itself out through the internal address book. And we had to reset everybody's credentials.
You're giving me flashbacks.
I mean, even on some levels, and I know this is super paranoid, and I apologize, but that's my nature. Even when you're attending conferences, and you're attending conferences like this, there are situations where people aren't necessarily wearing badges. It may be at a social event, and you can be social engineered very quickly to provide a lot of details about your platform that you really shouldn't be talking about. And there, I mean, it's great to be able to be in this environment and talk and share and collaborate, but also be mindful that there are people who engage in social engineering at large events, at DEF CON, at, you know, other conferences that are engaging in espionage, or they are trying to do something to get information about your platform to abuse it and to compromise it later. It doesn't have to be they sent you a phishing email. It could be somebody who's really pretty, who's really interested. It's just, if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
I mean, I was always kind of a classic fly by the seat of my pants ops person, just get things done quickly. I've worked for a lot of smaller companies, so just move fast and forget about it later. It's only taken a couple of years of being kind of involved in the security space to realize that I'm, like you said, like starting to be paranoid. Like, I am so paranoid beyond belief because I've seen how far it goes, like down the rabbit hole, and not like the Snowden docs or whatever. Like, that's like kind of nothing because there's like, it's just everywhere. Like, everything's broken.
Yeah, I mean, we all know that everything is broken in our own platforms, but we also have to remember everything is broken everywhere. And so,
and it's the platforms that you actually can't control that you use.
Yeah, and you can't. You're like, oh, wow, if it's this bad, because, you know, we all have skeletons in our own operational closets. We all know this. And we try to do due diligence when we're evaluating vendors. But remember this, when you're evaluating vendors, ask those hard questions that you don't even want to answer about your own platform, because it's going to cause a problem and bite you. You got to know what those skeletons are. Yeah.
We do have a section on talking about third-party vendors. It's number six on here, just in case you were wondering where the sixth arrow is. We'll get there.
It's in the cloud.
But it's in the cloud. Before we get there, I wanted to talk about just the general. You build a really powerful service. You've got tens of thousands of virtual servers or physical servers, but you've got a lot of compute power. If somebody can get around your defenses to use that for their nefarious purposes, just imagine what kind of havoc they can wreak on the internet or whoever they're turning those against. It's like a botnet on serious steroids. The DDoS attacks that we've seen over the last year are nothing compared to what could happen if they were to take over any of the infrastructures that we run and use them for generating outbound traffic of any sort. So bear that in mind and keep an eye on it, because I can talk at a previous engagement that I worked on where we built a new email platform and didn't quite slam the door fast enough. We had a couple of days where the bad guys were able to just send millions upon millions of messages out through it before we could get the door slammed. So secure first and then put it into production. Don't secure it after you put it in production.
One thing that contributes to that, which might have pertinence here, is this concept of sleeper accounts or dormant accounts. So many times the way that you're able as a bad guy to amass such outbound resources, as outbound power, is by slowly stockpiling your accounts and then switching them on all at once. And the problem is that the naive approach that many of us, myself included, have taken in the past is saying, well, you know, we're worried about risk from new users, so let's say your account has to be 15 days old or 30 days old before it receives a full quota, or a year, or 3 years, whatever it might be. We find many, many cases where accounts are deliberately groomed, or even that it's just a side effect of the way that this black market infrastructure now sells accounts that are then purchased in bulk and then used for the crime, that we see many, many old dormant accounts that suddenly light up, and you can have, you know, 10,000 accounts, 100,000 accounts coordinating a single attack. So what that means is, you know, think about accounts that are coming in, and think about accounts that are coming in and idle as, you know, they shouldn't be earning or accruing reputation simply by being old. Like, they need to do good things to get positive reputation, not simply stick around in your network long enough that they're, you know, de facto good.
Yeah, one thing I always tell our data scientists is, unlike your grandparents, age doesn't equal increased trust.
Yeah, so it just reminds me. I know that we're already having Doctor Who references, but here a great example is on Battlestar Galactica. Boomer shot Adama, and it's because everybody's like, oh, wait, she's activated as a Cylon. So it's one of those things. You've got to look for your Cylon accounts in your system. They're there.
Okay, so third parties. They're trusted to some degree. You let them in. Target found to their dismay that their air conditioning vendor, HVAC vendor, was not quite to be trusted as much as... It wasn't the vendor that was not to be trusted as much as their security practices that were not to be trusted. Corey, you want to talk about vetting third parties?
Sure. So one of the things that I look at, and I would encourage you to look at when you're looking at third parties in your ecosystem, and that can be everything from where you store your source code to who handles your email to who's providing domain registrars or DNS services to you, who's monitoring your environment, crash analytics, user analytics. You've got a lot of things that you actually depend on that you might not actually realize have that much of a security impact. When you look at things like account provisioning and permissioning, when the guy who signed up for that that GitHub account or that New Relic account left the company, a few months ago, did you remove that account? You might have gone and cleaned up the things that are internal to your environment, but what about the third party and cloud accounts that you've had? Authentication and account recovery features are a particular challenge. We've seen attacks on mail providers in order to just get to the account recovery, because if you take over someone's email, then you can reset most of their cloud services that are dependent, that your environment depends on. You should be demanding two-factor authentication for all of your services that support your production environment. I'm still surprised today to see that that's like an option or a roadmap item for some startups that are in this space. It should be a requirement. Additionally, things such as excessive sharing of user data or sensitive information, we see, like for example, mobile analytics software or crash analyzers dumping entire request and response bodies to those providers, which include authentication cookies, include user data, and storing it into their analytics systems, which were never designed to be a secure repository of data. So you need to make sure that when you're using these third-party SDKs or the like, that you actually have the capability of filtering or stripping that data out. And also, look at all the beacons and all the third-party JavaScript code that you're jamming into your user experience. Your trust model, it relies on the least secure of all of those third-party JavaScript providers that you're putting onto your page. And then finally, before you have an incident with one of these providers, why don't you go and take a look at the audit logs that they provide you? Ask them for it. Simulate an incident. Ask them, say, okay, I actually need to know how many people logged into these accounts and what they did for the last month. Try to find that out before you actually need that.
And from a compliance perspective, you were talking about crash analytics and dumping of data. If in that process you've all of a sudden dumped full credit card information, you've now increased your scope for PCI compliance, and anybody who's gone through PCI compliance assessment will know that is extremely painful. So you have to think about where are there situations where data typically wouldn't touch those platforms, but it's completely possible for them to fail in such a way where they become in scope for different types of compliance.
A lot of times too, this is where building all of this stuff, you know, into your deployment and integration pipelines, you know, you may not be, you know, dumping credit card or personal information out on a stack trace now, but all it takes is one bad code review, which, you know, those never happen, to then dump this data out, you know, so if you can basically simulate these events in advance, you know, assuming that the worst is going to happen and analyzing that data prior to it as part of your, you know, deployment processes, you can, you know, stay ahead of the game.
And along the lines of the web beacons that Corey mentioned, keep in mind the recent articles that have pointed out the massive exposure of personally identifiable, or at least information that can be de-identified, de-anonymized, that track health inquiries around the web. From WebMD is probably the one that I saw the most articles ranting about, that they feed tracker information about whatever you're inquiring about to a wide variety of folks. Is that something you really want your service to be known for in New York Times headlines?
Especially in the EU, the data's considered, the data classification is a little bit different. So here, when we think of personally identifiable information, we think social security numbers, we think credit cards. But in Europe, sensitive information also includes health information. It could be sexual preference and orientation, as well as any trade associations or political association. So if you're gathering that information and starting to build a profile that may have other things that you may be known for that you're sharing that you didn't expect to share.
And remember that it isn't just the quality of the encryption on your third-party service, mm-hmm. but it's how easily they can be breached. It's you may have ironclad encryption, data at rest, data in motion is all covered, but if you've got somebody that can be hit over the head with a wrench until they reveal the way to get into it, that opens you up, or a third party can open you up.
There are particular wrenches that you recommend defending against?
Large ones.
I recommend a hard hat deployment. Oh,
okay. I had a situation where an employee, he sends encrypted email, he's an extremely paranoid person, had his laptop stolen, had the whole bag, everything stolen out of his car on the weekend. You know, it wasn't where he was traveling. It just was completely unexpected. And he started sending encrypted, lost his mobile phone. And he started sending encrypted email saying, oh, please have these things shut off this, shut off that. And I said, I don't actually know that your laptop hasn't been stolen and that you are actually the person sending encrypted email, because I know that people in the company store their passphrases. So if the session is still live, you could be sending encrypted email and that's not actually the person. And I said, I apologize that you're going through this right now and you're asking me to shut down your bank account or your corporate bank card. But I can't do that until I get audio or visual confirmation that you are who you say you are. I'm assuming you are my employee, but I don't know for certain. And thankfully, because I can do an audio, because I've spoken with him. But what if you're a large organization and you've never met that employee? You have no idea what he looks like. You have no idea what he sounds like. Do you have ways to indicate you are truly who you claim to be? Or are you just some random person who says, yeah, I'm so-and-so who works in that foreign office that you've never met?
I've seen this as well with as more and more companies do remote people, where I went into a company one time and as new people were being hired in, there was a separate team that was basically enabling their access, and that team was not authenticating who those people were in any sort of identifiable way. It wasn't even like, give me your address or something. They weren't checking anything. So literally any person could, if they were somehow into the environment, could, you know, create a ticket in the environment, you know, here's my SSH key and give me this access. And, you know, they just never thought about it. They're like, well, you know, of course they're new hires. I'm like, how do you know they're a new hire? You know, did you, you know, get their driver's, you know, address or last four of their social or something that you can go and correlate with the HR team or something like that? But it was just something that was never thought of, especially in the remote world.
And as Jamie's pointed out, if you're dealing with people who are traveling to various countries who may have different policing procedures, you should probably also have a way to know that it may be the right person, but you want to make sure that they're not under duress when they're making that request.
That was the other reason why I wanted an audio confirmation, is because he could have been in a situation where he wasn't safe. We don't have those special phrases like the bird flies over the barn at midnight, right? So that's special. But I do know companies that do have, for very sensitive employees or for executives, a phrase that they use if they are in trouble or to prove that they are actually in a safe place and it is who they claim to be.
I think the biggest thing is, like most things, you know, we test when we deploy software, we test, we monitor, we do all these different things. You know, test these incident response plans. You know, if a laptop is stolen, who is called? Who's alerted? Who's woken up in the middle of the night? You know, in my case, I have a document that everyone knows, like, if you laptop is gone, like, you're going to call Pete at 2 a.m. I will not care. I will be very happy if you call me at 2 a.m. But if I go in the office at 8 and you walk into my office and say, hey, I lost my laptop last night, that's probably not going to be okay. But these are all scenarios that you should test, because the one thing I've realized is when revoking credentials or having to roll credentials, there are hundreds of things that you never thought of or never planned for because you probably didn't test it out in advance.
So I did want to make sure that we had some takeaways, because I know this has been a wide-ranging discussion. So I've put them up here, and rather than reading through them, I'll just invite anyone from the panel who wants to highlight any of them to make some comments, and then anyone who wants to ask questions, hop on up, because I know lunch is coming next, and we'll stay as long as you guys want to talk, but otherwise we'll let folks go. So any questions from the floor or comments from the panel here about the takeaway points or anything else you want to underscore?
Yeah, I mean, the encrypt everything, you know, PGP is terrible, but it's kind of the best we have. You know, one thing that I've done is kind of enforce PGP on everyone to the pain of everyone. But by forcing PGP on everyone, we can hopefully ensure that everyone has a means for communication securely and sharing secrets securely. Even though I had to sit with my CEO for hours as he set up his PGP and his personal support for it, it's everyone is forced to have it on there. I don't know how many people have used S/MIME for secure messaging, but it's a wild joke. Our CTO lost his key and had to revoke it, and it was as simple as emailing a unnamed company to revoke the certificate, and they said, yeah, sure, no problem, and it was revoked. So there is no real authentication there. So as painful as a lot of these things are when it comes to encrypting everything, the time spent is well worth it.
And to address the last point about users and attackers will use and abuse your platforms in ways you'll never expect, one of the things that we've seen is that attackers will submit false abuse complaints against different content on social platforms, and it will silence journalists or activists that are trying to organize events, that are trying to communicate to the outside world. So sometimes that report of an abusive event may not actually, may be motivated by something else other than true content abuse.
Well, and we see that, I mean, in the trade press, you can regularly read about false DMCA reports of trying to take down content, claiming that it is infringing when it's not. Even companies, one person from the company files a takedown request because the PR arm of the company posted it.
Yeah.
So, please.
So I'm a little bit curious. So the security work is kind of never ending, and I'm wondering, so who inside your various companies like does this kind of work? Like, do you try to push this out to the different software engineers, do your operations teams, do that kind of stuff? Like, how do you balance like the endless pile of it against all the other stuff you guys have to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a journey, not a destination, right? So I think it depends on the company size. I've seen companies have the dedicated InfoSec team, which can have its own issues sometimes as they're kind of seen as the blocker. With the rise of DevOps or whatever practices, I think all about integrating security into the same tooling and pipeline. One thing that I even did at a previous company was teaching all the InfoSec people how to use all of the same config management tools that we were using to set up systems to then audit those systems. So like sitting down and like teaching people how to use like Chef and Puppet, you know, InfoSec people who have never used them before. So I think it's a little bit on kind of everyone, you know, everyone kind of, I don't say everyone owns it, but I think everyone's responsible for what they do, but they're only as responsible as kind of you enable them and teach them about it. So it's a lot of training and a lot of teaching.
It becomes something that you have to inculcate as part of the culture. And we're working in partnership between the SRE organization and the house security team at LinkedIn to have it become something that the devs are aware of and think about that they secure by default. And coming out the door, it's designed to be secure, it's designed to be safe, so that we don't need to roadblock them when they say, hey, we want to release today. And we say, well, did you go through security review? And they say, what security review? And it's like, okay, that's a non-starter.
Yeah, I mean, from LinkedIn's perspective, the SRE organization is one of the greatest security champions within our organization because they are actually able to flag things and make sure that security diligence has actually been applied. So so my team can work both as kind of as a consultative group as well as when we need to bring out the governance hammer. But for the most part, the idea is that when we work on it together, it works pretty well.
Yeah, I would say the same for Groupon. I know my team works a lot with our application and InfoSec teams, and like it takes a village. I mean, we're all working together to achieve the same goal, document everything, and then run through those tests prior, because that's the biggest thing. You don't want to have to answer those hard questions when you know that you're under that level of pressure.
Mark, you want to answer that question?
Six answered. Everybody. I mean, we mix it to all of them. Yeah.
Okay. Next. Oh, one disappeared. Okay.
So this is actually kind of related to the last question. So I feel like I'm privileged to work with some of the like best software engineers in the world, and yet their security mindset is almost non-existent in a number of the teams. Like the kind of problems I see on a day-to-day basis are just I don't know how they miss things. I was discussing this with Corey earlier. It's just it's a little bit ridiculous sometimes. I was just wondering how do we go about encouraging a security mindset from the ground up within our software engineering teams? I think that you've already mentioned we, you know, have to encourage them to do security reviews and things like that. But that's kind of a week or two in at least in the development process. It just seems like we miss some really, really basic things sometimes.
I think part of the challenge is as part of when people are starting out in their careers, there's not a focus on security when you're in application design or in software design. It's just, I mean, obviously get them while they're young and get them to learn about security, but that's great, but that's not going to help us today. I think it's something that needs to be part of an organization's culture where security is important. You keep talking about it. It's at part of onboarding. There's regular security, like incident response activities that everybody gets involved in and they can see their role, and that you've got a management support. So you need to be able also to say, okay, management, I need you to support me when we're talking about these that security is important, and that we make it a part of our software development lifecycle, that you educate your project managers and your product managers when they're designing things and saying, oh, we should think about privacy and security and user safety issues. And it just needs to be infused into the entire organization, because people are not coming in with that mindset from the beginning.
I mean, it's definitely hard, and I think like most things, you have to have someone who can be essentially a cheerleader around it that can essentially evangelize it internally. I know Etsy had done a really good job with kind of taking away the fear around reporting things to the security teams and having different events and things where they can kind of bubble up all of these things up to the different engineering teams. So it's no longer like, oh my God, I accidentally clicked this phishing link, I don't want to tell anyone. It's actually they're almost incentivized to let people know right away. I think taking kind of the stick approach away of, you know, beating people until they're, you know, submissive on the security side is helpful, and treating it much more like, I mean, everyone says like we take security seriously. It's just a meme at this point, but I think it's more like, you know, you take it seriously like you take uptime seriously and you take performance seriously. It's just another thing that you have to do. And I think we all have to get better at, I mean, you mentioned like it's a couple of weeks to the you know, development process. I think we have to get better about communicating why it's important to kind of build these in and actually get that into the schedule as well. So it's not just like, oh, this is going to take 2 weeks to build. Actually, it's going to take about 3 weeks because we want to run it through some like external pen test first, you know.
One thing that could work for culture change, in addition to what these two have said, is there's sort of a fun puzzle-solving aspect to some of these security things. So we do, at our company and at others I've been at, things like an Orange Team event where people are essentially trying to slip something past, things like a hackathon where you're trying to break that, as well as some kind of fun training programs. So we built, actually, we went to DEF CON Kids last year and taught a XSS, like a cross-site scripting tutorial there. And basically, as people work through it, it's kind of fun. It's kind of like solving puzzles, but it might, you know, subliminally inculcate this mindset.
I mean, if you've got a vulnerability disclosure or a bug bounty program for the outside world, you can do it internally, too. There's nothing wrong with trying to inspire somebody who may find... Now, you're responsible for the bugs in your own code, and you should not get a bug bounty right back. Let me just be clear.
I'm going to code myself a minivan.
No, you can do that.
Look at all these cross-site scripting methods.
No, not that. But if somebody from another team is looking, that's great. It's another pair of eyes. It's somebody who's saying, I'm going to back my team up, and sure, I get something out of it, or you get, you know, some sort of recognition. But it's important to think about those types of programs that you're incentivizing externally, also internally.
Team up with a buddy and you can get paid.
Yeah.
Always a way to gain.
One of the things that I've also found that's important is to actually share incident reports and threat intelligence with the wider population, so they actually understand what's going on in your environment and what things they need to defend against. One of the things that we as security people often do, unfortunately, is kind of go into a shell and put everything as a need to know, and it's not the right approach, because the more that you share about the struggles and the bad guys that you're fighting, the more you can get the buy-in right up at the head. On the other side, you know, like kind of basic remedial failures of security engineering, I think, unfortunately, you know, we're missing a good curriculum in that space as a whole. Security training sucks for the most part, and so that's another problem that we have to solve.
Yeah, I'll be asking another question. So it seems like we're talking about treating security kind of the same way we treat ops, right? Like monitoring systems for uptime and all that.
Sorry, can you use the mic a little closer?
Yeah, so we're talking about treating security the same way we treat ops, which is that we apply the same kind of rigor to keeping systems secure as we do keeping them operational. But for keeping systems operational, it seems like we have like a whole range of tools that we can use to do that, right? We have like automated alerting, we have like staging environments where we can like run testing to make sure things will scale. And I'm wondering what kind of stuff like that exists for security work. Like what kind of automated tooling, or like is it really just like people staring at the code, or is there anything beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for like on the code side. I can only speak for the system side. Is there definitely are, you know, tools out there, and I say this like they're painful to use. I think one of the cool things, you know, everyone here probably has some sort of centralized logging set up already. You know, you can have things like AuditD sending to those same centralized logging platforms. You know, you can set up OSSEC for, you know, monitoring file system events and monitoring for host-based events. You know, and you can have all these report up. You know, even a very simplistic way is to start looking for different anomalies in just your normal system logs in those same kind of aggregated, you know, centralized logging tools and things like that. So, but, and I think this goes back to kind of the lessons in training around security is that because there's not a lot of that, the tooling is all very kind of painful. For lack of a better word. And so people do struggle with it. And so I think just as an industry, the good news is we're all talking about it. So there's a lot of people that are trying to kind of improve those pieces. But, you know, it's I think it'll take some time as more and more people start kind of investing in that.
Well, I think there are some practices in the QA space that instead of just checking for positive things, you intentionally throw bad content at a service when you're QAing it, and you check to make sure that it fails in the expected way, I'll put it that way. So Microsoft, I think, was one of the ones that's been fairly public about their attempts to deal with buffer overflow exploits. But when your QA is testing the input string and they only put in 30 characters, they're not testing for buffer overflow. When they put in 30K, maybe they're getting there. So it is an expanded QA role can help as well. Any thoughts from anyone else?
So one of the things coming down the pipeline that I'm interested in is the CISPA, the cybersecurity bill that's possibly coming down the line. And it seems kind of, from the discussion I hear, kind of criminalizing white hatting in a lot of ways and actually doing that. Since you guys are all big industry players, what is your perspective on it? Do you think it's more helpful than hurtful? Because it's trying, I mean, generally I think it's, the idea is to aid that so they can go after the bad people, but do you think it will do more harm than good by hurting the people who are actually doing research and doing bug bounty programs and things like that?
Placing a chilling effect on security research is the absolute opposite direction we need to go. That's my position, not necessarily LinkedIn's position, but that's how I feel about it.
I mean, bug bounty programs, if your company doesn't have one, you should have one. I mean, it's short money, and there's people out there who happily will find things that you've never, and this is, I mean, I'm at a startup, we're 20-something person startup, and we will absolutely pay bug bounties when people find things, and there's a lot of other companies that I know that do that as well, that don't even have, like, you know, the pretty GitHub page with all the different things they're looking for, but still have those ways in which, you know, people can safely report, you know, those types of issues.
Yeah, there are companies that'll administer it for you, so if you're a small agency, all you have to do is set aside the right money, and then the rest of it's kind of handled.
And you don't even have to do a paid bug bounty. I mean, there are just free swag vulnerability disclosure programs. And they, sure, you get a different quality of bugs, but it's a good practice to get started in. And then as you grow, you create a bug bounty program that you actually put money behind. CISPA is really disconcerting because people who are in the community, who are in the security community and in the intel space, know how to share information. They're already doing it. The fact that we have to legislate it so that the government can be a part of it is a little bit problematic. There are a lot of organizations that are pushing back against CISPA, but it's moving forward because that's what happens when government gets involved in regulating things that they probably shouldn't. So it's unfortunate. I don't think it's going to completely criminalize it, but there's also concerns about, well, if you give people the ability to hack back, what does that mean? If a large organization, large Fortune 500 company has a lot more resources, what does that mean if they want to justify to hack back one of their smaller upstart emerging technology competitors? That hasn't been talked about yet. So that could happen.
Right. So. And on those notes, we'll let you adjourn to lunch. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.